chick flicks, romantic comedies, rom-coms. You love them, you hate them,
but we are here to eviscerate them. Welcome to the Rom-Com Killjoys podcast.
We are your hosts, Eliza Bertrand
and Janelle Walker. Now, let's get on with some feminist joy killing. In this, the dwindling end of our calendar year, we think back to the past. We think of a simpler time when men were sailors and they embraced the terrifying arms of our dark mother, the sea. Welcome back to Rom-Com Killjoys. Hey, Eliza.
Hey, Janelle. Welcome back. Welcome to all our listeners. I hope you guys are having a good October. I know we're celebrating away.
Yes, the spooky season is upon us, and the film that we're talking about this week is not obviously spooky, but as I allude to, its subtext is actually kind of scary, including its frankly shocking ending.
I found quite a few things disturbing about this movie. It, you know, we picked it for its fairy tale elements, but I think it's more on the nose with the Halloween stuff than I realized.
Yeah, surprise, guys. This is a horror movie podcast now. Welcome to it.
Yeah, it's a surprise to our audience and to us. But anyway,
we played ourselves.
The movie we're talking about this week, in case you haven't realized, is Splash, which I really didn't think was going to be a horror movie. Janelle, why don't you tell us a little bit about the movie?
Oh, God. Must I? All right, I must. Here we go. Here's the Google summary. Splash. The year of our Lord, 1984. A young boy, played by Tom Hanks, is saved from drowning by a beautiful mermaid, played by Daryl Hannah. He falls in love with her, and 20 years later, she returns to seek him out. Before he can choose between life on dry land or a deep-sea paradise with his dream woman, the lovers are rudely interrupted by the intervention of a scheming scientist, played by Eugene Levy. That's what Google says Splash is about. But what are the deep, dark horrors of Splash?
Well, I gotta tell you, Janelle, Splash is disguised as a romance, as a love story, but it's really about a bunch of fairly disturbing male fantasies. From the romance to the revelation about the supernatural to the surprise army chase at the end, military chase at the end, it's all a bunch of very disturbing male fantasies about machoism and being the toughest guy in the room.
Yeah, that was a thought that struck me from the very early moments of this film, pretty much from the moment that in the flashback that the film starts with, Freddy, who's played by the late John Candy, his younger version, is dropping pennies on a boat deck to look up women's skirts. And I realized in that moment that we had unfortunately traveled backward in time before when rom-coms were about 99% centered on female experiences. And it suddenly made me extremely grateful for something like How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days, which is not a feeling I enjoy.
Yeah. I gotta ask, before we go on, is this a thing that a lot of kids in the 60s and 70s did, dropped coins and then looked up women's skirts? Because I feel like I've seen this in so many movies and TV shows and never seen it in real life. Like, what is it that they think all 9-year-old boys are doing that this is like a recurring movie trope?
I'm really not sure, and I hope that this has something to do with some, like, I don't know, sitcom joke from the 50s and the 60s, which I could buy as like a slapstick comedy joke from that period. But what is so disturbing about it is that John Candy's character continues to do it as an adult in the 80s.
Yeah, and the people making this movie, which include the director Ron Howard, seem to feel that adult women wouldn't notice a man just crouching beneath them and staring up their skirt, which is another very concerning thesis of this movie.
Exactly. There's that scene where he does that just outside the church before the wedding. And as he's standing with Tom Hanks' character, Alan, as an usher at the wedding, the women pass by, they're all greeting Alan, and they don't greet Freddie. They all sort of look disgusted at him. And the film sort of plays this as a laugh, like, haha, that scamp. The women just hate that he does that. But he's like a sexual predator, and they're avoiding him because he's a sexual predator.
Yeah. Though to be fair, I don't know that his brother, the main character played by Tom Hanks, isn't a sexual predator in this movie.
Do go on.
Okay, so for anyone who hasn't seen this movie, the main love story begins when Daryl Hannah, as a mermaid who, when she's dry, has human legs, falls in love with Tom Hanks's character and decides to exit the water and follow him to New York because she's so enamored with him. She does not at this point speak English or, as far as we can tell, any human language, and their only interactions have been once seeing each other underwater as children and then once kissing passionately on a beach while she was completely naked, and they exchange no words. And when she arrives in New York, is arrested for nudity but has his wallet, so they manage to call him. He comes to the police station, gets custody of this woman, whose name he cannot provide to the police officers. He then takes her in the, like, t-shirt they've given her home with him and sleeps with her. They've had no conversations. He has no evidence of who or what she is. He assumes that she is a immigrant to the country who does not speak a word of English. The police, again, release her to his custody with no proof that he has any right to her other than that she seems to have found his wallet. And then he takes her home, they make out, and then they have sex.
Yikes. Yep. Unfortunately, this film is an early example. I mean, I guess not the earliest, because some of the trope neighbors would trace this back to the 1950s, but it's a fairly early example of a trope that some people call the born sexy yesterday character. The most prevalent version of which in contemporary popular culture is probably Lilu from Fifth Element. It's a female character who is absolutely beautiful, but has the mind of a child that can be shaped by the man that accompanies her. And yet she provides a certain kind of folksy, otherworldly wisdom. But he kind of tells her how to integrate through the world. So he's simultaneously her father and her lover. It's gross.
It's so gross. And there are versions that are technically the trope born sexy yesterday that are less disturbing than this. There are versions where the woman's just more naive or more innocent, you know, something like in Enchanted, where she's unfamiliar with the modern world, but she is an adult woman who has her own thoughts and feelings and emotions and speaks English and all those kind of things. And they also take several days before they begin to develop a romantic connection, during which time she has learned more about the world. Like, something like that, some people may not like it, but it's less overtly disturbing. Whereas this is, like, straight up, this is the trope. She knows nothing, she behaves and interacts with the world like a child, and his first immediate interaction with her is a purely sexual one, which bothers him not at all at any point. Which is so strange.
And it really speaks to white male privilege that he wasn't terrified by the fact that she chased him down from Cape Cod. Mm-hmm. In the nude?
Right, like there's no
concern.
That's
an aggressive move.
There's no concern that this is a, fatal attraction kind of situation.
Mm-hmm.
Which makes me laugh because Tom Hanks references Fatal Attraction in Sleepless in Seattle when his character is concerned about that sort of a thing. But no, he's just like, yeah, this woman has shown up naked on my doorstep and wants to have sex with me. Why would I question this? I am an exceptional human being who deserves this sort of behavior from the women around me. When he has not been an exceptional human being, I gotta say, especially early on in this movie, it was really sort of unsettling to see Tom Hanks playing such a kind of schlubby jerk. I feel like we've become so accustomed to Tom Hanks being, you know, America's dad, right? Like, he's just sort of pure and good and kind. And even in other movies where he plays tougher characters or rougher characters, even like A League of Their Own, where he's kind of an asshole drunk. He's an asshole drunk who, you know, is that way because of things that have happened in his past. And you also know by the end of the movie, he's going to have come out of it. And this wasn't like that. This was just sort of being like, oh yeah, he's kind of a jerk who, like, isn't good to his girlfriend and isn't good to his employees or his brother and kind of sucks. And then they just provide him with this mermaid.
Yes. I want to talk about the narrative framing of this story vis-a-vis the fairy tale, because what's weird about this is that it's listed as a fantasy and not a fairy tale, despite the fact that The Little Mermaid is distinctly part of the fairy tale genre.
Sure.
And this is certainly riffing off of that. But I think what keeps it fantasy is the exact thing that I'm about to talk about. So what I think is interesting in the narrative structure that you're referring to is that what we're set up with in the beginning of this film is that Alan has a problem. And Alan's problem is that he doesn't know how to love. And that's why his girlfriend Victoria rightly leaves him. He has a bit of a breakdown about it. And then the solution that the film provides him is a fucking mermaid.
Yeah, he's literally handed a mermaid who's in love with him and has been since she was a child. And he has to do absolutely nothing to have earned that or deserve that. You know, it goes back to that conversation we were having in our A Cinderella Story episode about what Cinderella and her stepsisters have to do in order to earn their happy endings or lack thereof, and how the prince doesn't have to do much to earn his. And I feel like this is like seeing that story purely from the prince's point of view and not learning anything more about the prince. It's really amazing, and it's definitely a completely unfounded male fantasy, right? Like, it's entirely about, yes, a beautiful, perfect woman will just fall into my arms and everything will click into place and I won't have to put in any effort to earn her or deserve her or keep her. You know, at two points in the movie, he almost loses her and then he changes nothing and she changes her mind and returns to him, right? Like, he freaks out when he finds out she's a mermaid and they're literally put in the same tank of water and he backs away from her. And then when they let him go, he then decides he needs to save her. He shows up and she jumps right back into his arms. There's nothing where she's like, when you were here a day and a half ago, you wouldn't even let me touch you because you were so freaked out. And now you're fine with it and I'm just supposed to come with you? And if she'd said that and he said, I'm sorry, I was wrong, I realize I still love you, I feel like you could be more okay with it, even though, like, that's not much of a redemption, but you at least, they've had the moment. There was no moment. He just shows up and it's like that other scene never happened.
Right. He's just supposed to be able to walk away with the, I've gotten over the fact that you're a mermaid. I've accepted it, and it is okay with me. Which is not a great moral for this story. When I finished watching it, I wrote down in my notes, ah, yes, men are from land, women are from water. A classic. Because essentially what this film teaches us in terms of, like, heterosexual dating ideology is that men and women are essentially different creatures. But don't worry, men. Women can be shaped by you as long as you sort of find a woman that's naive and malleable enough. I mean, it's very shocking to me the scenes where Daryl Hannah's character, Madison, who names herself after Madison Avenue, there's a lot there, folks. Yeah. We'll talk about the 80s consumerism in a minute. But primarily what I'm interested in are the scenes where she's sitting in the apartment and she's watching ads for fashion. And it's interesting because she immediately knows, even though she doesn't understand other sort of like on land concepts of culture, she immediately understands that not only are the fashion models what they're wearing desirable, but that she should wear them as a woman, right? Or as a feminine presenting person. But she steps out of the apartment wearing a suit. And when she gets to Bloomingdale's,
right, which she's managed to put together as a full suit. She's got like the shirt, the jacket, the pants, the tie. So somehow seeing him once in a shirt and a tie taught her how to tie a tie? Fascinating.
No idea how that is supposed to work. But when she gets to Bloomingdale's, she's confronted by a saleswoman who says, honey, that outfit is so out of date. Like, let me put you in some beautiful clothes that suit you. And even suggests that she go to the lingerie department so that she can wear beautiful underwear instead of boxers. And there's a lot there to unpack about how she's being acculturated to gender in this way that suggests that it's really natural, but also something that you have to be told to wear at the same time. It's a very confused message about that.
Yeah, it's very strange. The whole way that she learns about the world is very strange, and some of it is a bit of just sort of movie magic hand waving. But the fact that that hand waving is so intertwined with this strange gendered understanding of the world and this strange sexualized understanding of the world is especially confusing. It also, some of it's funny looking at it from a modern standpoint, because the 80s fashions in this movie are wild. And after her first, you know, handful of scenes in which she is either completely stark naked or just wearing like a t-shirt that they gave her that she's, you know, thrown on that barely covers her butt, then she spends most of the rest of the movie in like what we would consider a muumuu. Or like giant jackets. Like, they couldn't cover her up more. And it's so funny to watch because you know that she's supposed to be in what this movie is seeing as, like, the height of fashion. And she's so cool and chic and sexy. And I'm like, you cannot see one curve on her body anymore. What were the 80s that they were like, either she needs to be wrapped in pounds of wool or completely naked?
Eliza, I think you're getting at a really important thing that we sometimes forget about the 80s as an era, which is that in the US, at least, culture was very torn between being insanely, ridiculously conservative and this, like, little bit of subversion underneath it, right? So, like, you have your, mm-hmm. like, 80s punks, you have your 80s goths, but for the most part, it was an incredibly conservative culture and very materialistic. So tell me what you thought about all of that in the movie, like the materialism, the consumerism, the TV.
I mean, it definitely, like, you can tell watching this movie that it's made during the time when, like, the mall is really becoming, you know, the end all be all of when you go of where you go shopping and what you do with your time. You know, the fact that she can go somewhere and get an entire wardrobe of women's clothing. I mean, she's got boxes and boxes and boxes, and walk into, you know, a store filled with TVs and get shoes and get, you know, and all this kind of stuff. And that he has to, like, do a mad dash to the mall to go find her. And, you know, it's so much of the story is centered around this shopping experience. His, you know, his brothers constantly talking about trying to, like, get his crazy salacious stories into Penthouse, and then, like, buys 100 copies of Penthouse and is throwing them to everyone at the office. And his brother's doing all the schmoozing with big buyers for their company. And then they go to a big, fancy, expensive donor party where the president is at, right? Like, mm-hmm. everything is about money. His apartment is clearly very expensive, which is hugely confusing, because while he does seem to own a company, he owns a company that resells produce and yeah. seems to be relatively small, because they're surprised and excited that they got a big buyer for a, you know, main chain grocery store. So I don't know how he can afford a huge, expensive Upper East Side apartment with, like, views of the river, but he can, right? Like, so much about it is this consumerism. And she gets immediately wrapped up into it. And the story itself does not require it, right? Like, even if you accept the strangeness of her being, you know, caught by these scientists halfway through, and then of the military chasing them, and all of the strange elements of the movie, none of those plot points require there to be an underlying subtext about consumerism. And yet it's almost unavoidable.
Absolutely. I mean, it even ekes its way into her learning about the world, right? Like, the fact that, as you talked about earlier, the fact that she names herself after Madison Avenue, the fact that she learns everything she needs to know about life through TV. I mean, oh my God.
Well, and that's especially funny because this movie, which I would say today is not hugely popular, like, it certainly exists in our consciousness, and I know a lot of people, you know, remember it fondly from watching it when they were kids, but it's not like it's one of, like, the big movies that everyone watches. But it's had a surprisingly large impact on our culture today, currently, and so it's funny that so much of the story within the movie is about culture impacting the story, when the story has now done that in reverse. And the Madison Avenue naming scene is a really great example of this. Because they wrote that scene to be funny. Madison at the time was not used as a girl's name. It wasn't used as a first name at all, and was, you know, associated with one of our founding fathers and old men, and that's about it. So her seeing the sign Madison Avenue and picking that as a name was meant to be this weird, funny, like, oh, she's a fish out of water moment. And credited to this movie, the name Madison took off. A couple years later, by the 90s, it was one of the more popular names. And in the 2000s, it was consistently in the top 10 girls' names in America every single year.
Why do you think that name has had that impact? It's sort of, it is actually, when you step back from it, kind of bizarre.
I feel like often writers will pick whatever the current trendy names are and apply those to their characters, even if the ages don't necessarily match up. So, like, you might get some of the popular baby names right now might appear on characters who are older in a movie, and vice versa, because people are trying to, like, show the current trends. And so I think people often pick names off of pop culture figures because they do sort of line up with what's popular at the time. But there's not a lot of examples, at least so far, of a name truly coming directly from a single source like this. I think probably the closest examples we'd have now would be people being named after like Harry Potter characters or Game of Thrones characters. You know, you're starting to get little kids named like Hermione or Arya. And I guess that's the same sort of thing, and only time will be able to tell if, like, 20 years from now, every kid in school is named Arya, and you're like, ugh, God, not another one. But I think there was also something about that that at the time, it felt rich and wealthy and different and a little sort of snooty and unusual, and people liked that. They wanted their kids to sound like they belonged to families who lived on the Upper East Side of Manhattan.
It really strikes me hearing you say that, how much at odds those super, like, 80s in New York, you know, Donald Trump is king, themes are at odds with the mythological traditions of the mermaid. Because, right. Of course, the mermaid, especially in Western mythology, is actually a symbol of foreboding in some ways, a symbol of shipwrecks, a symbol of drowning. A foreboding symbol of death. So what do you make of that combination? Why is a mermaid the center of this weird little film?
You know, that's a great question, Janelle, and I'm not sure there is an answer. And I do think to a certain point, probably when making this film, some of that just wasn't really thought about. They liked the ideas, and so they threw them together, and they didn't necessarily step back to say, does this all make thematic sense? But even with mermaids being a sense of foreboding, I feel like most tales of mermaids are also about them being enticing, right? Like the tale of the siren is that they make the sounds that are the most attractive to the sailors in order to lure them to their deaths or lure them down into the land underneath the sea or, you know, whatever the version of the story is. And so there's something within that traditional folklore about the mermaid being an incredibly appealing, attractive element. And even in this movie, where she's also tied in with all these sort of modern things as well, she does ultimately succeed at the mermaid's goal of enticing the man to join her underneath the depths. Mm-hmm. Right? Like Tom Hanks leaves behind his life. He doesn't even say goodbye to his brother in order to join her under the sea. Which is like she comes up and experiences this brief, fun moment of contemporary America and then returns to the classical mermaid part of the story.
Yes, I like to think that there's a contra narrative going on in this film from her perspective, which is a lot darker to that end, mm-hmm. right? She very aggressively chases him down to New York. Very. And as you said, the film ends with them both underwater, even though we learn several times over that Alan doesn't know how to swim. So on some level, I like to think of this as a horror movie. Wouldn't that be nice that in the end, she like seduces him down to the sea and she kills him.
And kills him.
That would be great. Yes.
You know, I gotta say though, that final scene, especially as it like goes into the credits and you see them swimming around, made me so mad because give Tom Hanks a tail, you cowards.
Yes, make him a merman.
How dare they not imply that he then becomes a merman and gets a tail? Because I was waiting for shirtless Tom Hanks with a tail to be swimming next to shirtless Daryl Hannah with her tail, and it never happened, and I think that that shows incredible cowardice on the part of these filmmakers. Ron Howard, what are you doing to me?
Well, but see, I wonder, too, that there's a... If you want to get really heady in cultural studies about it, I think that that ending lends itself, like so many monster stories do, and on some level the mermaid is also a monster story, it lends itself to a queer reading as well, right? Like two creatures that are not supposed to be together ending up together. And the sort of transformations that Madison goes through from like hiding her tail, right? Like in private she has the tail and in public she has the legs. I mean, all of that stuff sort of lends itself that way. So it's interesting to think about that ending suggesting that, no, you know what, Tom Hanks has come out that he is into ladies in the sea and he's into ladies on the land and he's not ashamed of that. He's just got a queer love for mermaids.
Well, you know, and you saying that, there's been a lot of talk in the last, like, year or two actually, I think a couple years. I think there's been talks since like 2017 maybe about doing a modern remake of Splash with the roles gender reversed. And Channing Tatum's name has been thrown out along with these rumors quite a bit. I don't know if he's ever actually agreed to it, but certainly there keep sort of resurfacing these stories that Channing Tatum is going to be in a gender-flipped Splash. And if that's the case, I think they really need to embrace it and just go for the queer story. Have him be a merman who falls in love with a human man. And just really give us the story we all want.
I want it so bad.
I want someone, Channing Tatum and Zac Efron to star in a gay Splash.
God, be still my heart. It would just be magical. It would be so great. And in the end, Zac Efron could become a merman and all of our dreams can truly come true.
And you know he'd be totally down for becoming a merman.
Absolutely.
He'd be like, glitter my chest, let's fucking do it.
He's been training for this his entire life. There's one other piece of pop culture trivia around this film that I want to talk about, Eliza. And it's that I did not realize that this film was made by the Walt Disney Company 5 years before they released The Little Mermaid.
Yeah. You know, this film has a very interesting connection with the Walt Disney Company because it was produced by Touchstone Pictures, which I'm sure is a production company who you've all seen in a number of movies now because they're quite prolific. But at the time, this was the first movie made by Touchstone Pictures, which Disney had created as a subsidiary label to produce more adult films. Which just meant films, you know, not directly marketed towards kids. And this one, I think, still had like a PG rating, even though you see butt crack all over the place. And there are a number of sex scenes. But they clearly wanted to have a more sort of adult-geared line as well. But as we know with Disney, everything they do is intertwined. And so I do wonder, and I'm pretty sure, that the success of this movie encouraged them that people might be interested in more mermaid stories. The Little Mermaid, which was being produced at the time, because all of those animation movies are produced over a number of years, was originally designed with blonde hair, but they changed it to red so as not to be too reminiscent of Daryl Hannah's character in this movie. So clearly they knew that this was going to be in people's minds. There's also an interesting thing where in this movie, in two scenes, actually, you get Tom Hanks singing Zippity Doodah from Song of the South, which is infamous for being Disney's movie that they pretend never happened because it was so racist even they couldn't hand wave it away. And Song of the South has been in the news a bit this year because of the Disney World attraction Splash Mountain, which is one of their most popular attractions, but is entirely based off of the characters from Song of the South, Br'er Rabbit and all of them. And Disney has said that they're looking into revamping Splash Mountain to be based on more modern characters and therefore less racist ones. But Splash Mountain, interestingly, which was created a couple years after this movie came out, although it features all of the characters from Song of the South, was named in reference to the movie Splash.
No.
Yes.
It was?
It was. So clearly Disney had Splash on the brain through all of the 80s and early 90s, right? Like, this movie was a success for them. It launched Touchstone Pictures. It encouraged them to explore the mermaid stories. It got its name onto a Disney World attraction, which is not a small feat to do within the Disney universe. And it's strangely tied into this movie that they like to pretend doesn't exist, Song of the South, and still managed to be that successful within their world. So this is an important movie to the Disney brand.
Well, there you go, Disney fan folks. I mean, there's some good trivia for you. I am surprised by that, but it does have my gears turning a lot about. So in recent years, I know that there's been sort of a mermaid fandom and sort of a feminist reclaiming of mermaids as sort of violent and foreboding characters, as sirens, as these very powerful beings that are related to the very feminized sea, the dark power of the feminized sea. But it's interesting to me that the Disney Company's versions of the mermaid are these sort of born sexy yesterday characters. I mean, when I was researching for this episode, one of the primary examples of that trope is Ariel from The Little Mermaid. So I'm very curious about how the mermaid appeals as a figure in romantic stories once you've literally removed her teeth.
The mermaid folklore is so fascinating because it does begin as this horror story and yet has inspired so much in our current culture, so many different forms of adoration and reproduction. You know, you get everything from, as you say, the sort of feminist reclaiming of the siren to, you know, things like the Mermaid Parade at Coney Island, which is just like a big, gay, fun, colorful celebration of, you know, of cross-dressing and of beach culture and all these kind of things. So I don't know necessarily what it is about this mythical creature that can inspire so many different interpretations, but all of which still become wrapped up in this original version of the tale.
Yeah, there's something about, like, I don't know, like, mermaids represent, at the same time as they're, like, kind of dark and scary in some ways, they are also, like, some, there's something, like, really beautiful about them and, like, otherworldly beautiful, like, impossibly beautiful, I guess, is the idea I'm getting to.
Well, and I think that we, as people, are drawn to the idea of something that overpowers our own sense of free will. And not necessarily in the, you know, sort of complete enslavement level, but something that's so magical that you can't help but to touch it, but to follow it, but to fall in love with it. There's something enticing about that, about not having to second guess yourself, about just giving yourself over to the magic of the moment, of the creature. You know, who doesn't want to just meet someone and immediately fall in love at first sight and be so entranced by them that there's no question in your mind they're the one for you, right? Like, those are appealing things to us. And so to then tie it in with a supernatural element, I get why people would be sort of obsessed with that concept.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And it does kind of give some credit, not a lot of credit, but some credit to Ron Howard and team, that maybe that is what the ending of the film is trying to get at, is that Alan, for all of his incredible faults, eventually, as we've said, with an asterisk, gives away to this sort of like romantic abandon. And he just allows himself to be taken by her. So maybe that is what the message of the film is ultimately, that, well, love requires sacrifice and abandon in a way that Alan wasn't initially willing to do.
Sure. I think there's definitely, that's definitely part of the story they're trying to tell. I don't know if they successfully tell it, but that's certainly, I think, one of the ideas they're trying to come across. There's one other thing that I wanted to bring up, just because I think it does tie in nicely with some of the conversations we've had over the last few weeks. I found it really significant that when she follows him down to New York, she first enters the city at the Statue of Liberty. And there's this whole scene of her arriving at the Statue of Liberty as she enters the world of people. You know, you've seen her on land once before when they're on the beach at Cape Cod, but they don't interact with anyone else. There's no buildings around, right? Like, that still sort of seems to be, like, within the world of the ocean. Excuse me. Within the world of the ocean. And then when she actually enters into the, you know, the modern culture and the world of humans, it's through the Statue of Liberty. And there's this sort of strange American mythos element that then gets brought into this story on top of everything else, which I thought was surprising.
That is intriguing, especially because Alan keeps insisting that Madison is an immigrant. I hadn't thought about that, but that is so resonant.
Right, like they treat her like one. So it's just, it's interesting how we keep finding all these little elements of the American mythology being wrapped up into these, you know, older, maybe more European or non-Western even stories and legends and folklore that we have. It's, you know, these movies keep finding ways to make the story American somehow.
That is an important thing, I think, for our listeners to think about. If I put my professor hat on, in all parts of American culture, that it's always key to look for those moments where American cultural producers are trying to graft the story of America to something bigger than what America actually is, because there's a lot of propaganda and ideology that gets wrapped up in that, and not in a good way. So any moment where you can do what we're doing now and sort of peel those things apart is really important.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it struck me, I think, because I immediately understood what they were going for when she arrived at the Statue of Liberty, right? Like, I was like, she's entering the new world, and he understands her as an immigrant who needs to learn about our new culture and be, you know, adapted into it. And it didn't take me longer than a half second of thinking about it to understand what they were going for, because those mythologies are so ingrained in us, for good or for bad.
Wow. And then that really, what you're saying really puts the scenes where she's being held by the government in that facility in a totally different light as well, that she is so infreaked, and she's really, yeah, she's held by the government as a kind of oddity.
She is othered by the government itself. She is held for questioning and study by the government itself. They have to escape from the military and return to the old world. You know, it's a very strange thing to bring into this story that on the surface seems like it's quite light and silly.
Yeah, again, it's very interesting that this film, made by, and we'll say it again, the Walt Disney Company and Touchstone Pictures, has several layers deep of bigger and broader themes and imagery. But like a lot of the movies that we cover, they don't quite thread the needle on making them part of the conscious narrative. It's a lot of like unconscious or background storytelling.
You know, I was excited to watch this movie because I've heard so many people mention it over the years, and I've never managed to get around to watching it, and I really wish that I still hadn't seen it. But I think ultimately, you know, it's a movie about a male fantasy, as I said at the beginning, and not a particularly, to me, attractive one. So that makes it hard to relate to it, and a lot easier to rip it apart.
Yes, I agree. I do wish that I had this time back from my life. I think the hardest part for me was seeing the moments where Madison had great agency and initiative, you know, chasing him down, really asserting what she loved, really being the aggressor in their romantic encounters. But in the end, he was leading her through the world. He was treating her like a child in a woman's body. And that is not a romantic structure that I want to live inside. Sorry, Disney. Nope. All right, well, that's what we thought about Splash. As you can tell, it was we didn't think a lot of it. We did not think a lot of it. Tell us what you thought on social media. I know there are some 80s and Disney fan buffs out there, so let us know.
Yeah, if you feel strongly about this movie, please defend it.
Good luck. Before we transition to our antidotes, and boy, this week they will be sorely needed, we always want to give a shout out to our romantic leads on Patreon. Bob, Esther, Ian, and Trey, you guys are seriously the best. We are more thankful for you than ever. Thank you.
And for anyone who's really enjoying listening to our episodes and wants to get access to more content, we encourage you to go check out our Patreon. You can now become a patron for as little as $1 a month, which is just $12 a year. And doing this gives you access to a small amount of additional content, as well as to our monthly polls, where you can help us pick one of the movies that we talk about in the following month. So definitely check that out. And for additional money, we have several tiers you can pick from. You'll also gain access to things like cutting room floor edits that don't make it into final episodes, additional content with us talking about movies that we maybe don't do a full episode on. Also, every month we release a newsletter in which we put a lot of the research that we've done into these movies into it, as well as some additional thoughts on our themes and on the movies themselves. So go check that out and become a patron, become part of the conversation. We'd love to have you. All right, and with that, I think that takes us to the last part of the episode. This movie was a lot, and I think we definitely need a palate cleanser after it. So, Janelle, what are your antidotes this week?
I'm very excited about my antidotes this week, in part because we are coming on to my favorite time of the year. It is so nearly the high spooky holiday, everyone. Just one more week till Halloween. So I have two recommendations this week that sort of tend towards the horrifying subtext that we found in this film that are related directly to mermaids. The first is Dave Eggers' 2019 movie, The Lighthouse. It was a critically acclaimed movie that came out last year. You might have seen it. Cinematography is gorgeous, but the reason why I'm recommending it is because it involves a Very scary and at times sexy, but mostly scary mermaid. Absolutely go see that and check out all of Dave Eggers' work. He's really brilliant. But my true antidote for this week is the gorgeous Guillermo del Toro film, The Shape of Water. The Shape of Water is the story of a mute woman and a fish man creature, a creature from the Black Lagoon, who's being studied by the government agency where she works. And it's about their love story. It really embraces the kind of freak narrative at play in the mermaid story, but it's actually truly romantic, and it really leans into the kind of queerness of their sexuality, of their place in society, and also the alluring romance of falling for a creature. So definitely go see or go stream Guillermo del Toro's The Shape of Water. Okay, Eliza, what are you proposing will save us from this horrible movie?
Well, okay, so I've got a couple of antidotes. I've got three. I have three antidotes, but they're all very different.
Okay.
So my first would be, if you're looking for a sort of aquatic adjacent story, love story, and Shape of Water is not your thing, I actually want to recommend the movie Overboard from 2018, starring Anna Faris. It's a remake of a not particularly good movie from the 80s, from I think 1987. And the 1987 version, which has Goldie Hawn and Kurt Russell, is about a wealthy heiress who falls off of the side of her yacht, gets amnesia, and then a poor single dad who she's screwed out of money convinces her that he is her husband and that she is a stay-at-home mom who takes care of their kids and cooks and cleans for him, which is a very disturbing storyline. And for some reason, someone felt the need to remake this movie in 2018, which they did with Anna Faris, and they gender swapped it. So it's a rich asshole guy who gets amnesia, and it's a single mom with three daughters who gets her money back from him by convincing him that he's her husband, and he does a lot of the cooking and cleaning in the house and taking care of the kids. And it's a weird premise, but like the movie kind of acknowledges that it's a weird premise, but somehow the gender swapping makes it much less creepy. Mm. They also include... most of the cast are Latinx characters, including the male love interest and most of like the friends and that sort of stuff. And through that inclusion, by having him be like a Mexican, you know, heir to an oil tycoon or something like that, they include all of these elements of telenovelas. And so the craziness of the story is a lot easier to take within the telenovela framing. And so this movie that starts with this very strange premise that when I first watched it, I watched it with a friend and we were like ready to just completely pan it. By the end, it's surprisingly touching. It actually ends up being quite sweet in the end when you're dealing with like the kids' emotions about the situation and the families deciding how to handle their families. And I was not expecting to like this movie and certainly not expecting to be like emotionally affected by it. And yet I was. It's very cute. So if you're looking for like a genuine rom-com that will make you feel good about the ending rather than supremely uncomfortable, but that still has like some weird sort of the magic of the water and all of that kind of stuff included in it, I would check out Overboard from 2018. Now my other two suggestions. One, I was thinking about the whole Madison thing. And the, you know, Madison not even being a girl's name and now being like the most popular girl's name in America, all because of this one movie. And if that kind of stuff interests you, those sort of cultural and linguistic quirks, I would suggest checking out a YouTube video called Accent Expert Breaks Down Language Pet Peeves. It's a Wired video featuring the dialect coach Eric Singer. He's done a bunch of videos for Wired, all of which are kind of interesting. He does a bunch where he like critiques actors' fake accents in movies and stuff like that. But this is a really interesting one because he's talking about linguistic pet peeves that people have. And he talks about certain things like upspeak,
And vocal fry, and talks about how those are often, most often critiqued in women. And so there's, you know, sort of some weird misogyny elements there. But he also talks a lot about the grammatical things that annoy people that are based on pretty arbitrary grammar rules that were in many cases only invented a couple hundred years ago, but have now become sort of our accepted understanding of language. And he defends the things like saying literally when you mean figuratively or things like that, saying that like this is part of how language is currently evolving, and it's not that it's wrong, it's that it's different or that it's correct in the right cultural situation. Mm-hmm. And so it's a really interesting video. It's not that long, but it's very interesting, and I would suggest checking that out if that kind of thing appeals to you. And then finally, if you're looking for, like, you know, some good fun Halloween shenanigans, you know, this movie Splash, we thought it was going to be nice and light, and it ended up being incredibly disturbing. So I'm going to suggest something that's the opposite, that has the framework of a horror movie, but really is nice and light. And that's the episode of Boy Meets World, And Then There Was Sean, which is my favorite episode of Boy Meets World, one of my favorite episodes of TV ever. And it's all of the Boy Meets World characters in high school, and they're put into a sort of classic horror movie situation. The doors are locked, they can't get out, people keep dying. But it's a lot of fun. It's a nice pastiche of, like, all of the horror movie tropes, but it's obviously very silly and all tongue-in-cheek, and it's a great thing if you're looking for just, like, something to get you in the Halloween mood, but that's, you know, just sort of fun and easy. So go watch And Then There Was Sean if you need a brief palate cleanser.
I love all those recommendations, and especially that last one, because I watched Splash on Disney Plus, so I got the horrifying CGI hair butt. but what I got out of that that was positive was that I found out they have the whole Treehouse of Horror collection from The Simpsons. So yes. I'll be binging that this weekend.
Oh, so many good Halloween episodes. We could do an entire month just talking about my favorite Halloween episodes of television. There's so many.
And maybe one day we shall, listeners. Maybe one day.
Stick around till next year.
Thank you for listening to the Rom-Com Killjoys podcast. If you liked what you heard, be sure to follow us on Facebook and Instagram.
If you'd like to support us further, you can become a patron at patreon.com/romcomkilljoys.
Our theme song is Lady Slut Hitchhike Love by the band A Giant Dog, and the song you're listening to now is a cover of Baby Love by Colin Langaness.
Remember, Killjoys, don't let anyone kill your joy.
Not a rom-com. Not us.
Not anyone.
See you next time.
Instead of breaking up, it starts and kissing and making up.